Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host, and we're going to evolve even more, hopefully. This is an ongoing discussion with Steve McIntosh, our guest, for his book, The Presence of the Infinite, The Spiritual Experience of Beauty, Truth, and Goodness. We all love those, beauty, truth, and goodness. That's wonderful. And we're going to find out how to employ them better in our lives, spiritually, actually, since we all are spiritual, whether we know it or not. And so let's talk with Steve and get into this trip a little bit more. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Peter. Pleasure to be with you again today.
Yeah, thanks so much. This is very exciting to talk about. What is it that's going to move our society forward? You know, how are we going to deal with all of the differing views? And there's such an evolution of consciousness. At the same time, it feels like society is going backwards. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that there's a kind of what's known as a dialectic of progress and pathology, that as you make progress in the development of society, this inevitably produces new problems that have to be solved at a still further, higher level. In other words, every level of development produces existential problems, which are sort of the direct result of its own success.
Well,
and
isn't
those existential problems can't be solved at the level that created the problems.
Right, but isn't that true for the entire
redefinition, which is where we are now. You know, people want to redefine globalizing modernism. But most of the progressive suggestions involve getting rid of it or you know, constraining it in a way that loses its vitality. So the question of how we deal with the pathologies of modernism is really the question of our day and age. And this evolutionary perspective, which I'm part of, represents a fresh take on it. It's not about transcending and leaving behind. It's about transcending and including.
Well, I always say that we don't come into this life to have heaven on earth. We come here to try to create heaven on earth the hard way.
Exactly. It's a spiritual practice. In the book, I talk about perfecting the universe of self, culture, and our relationship to nature, that we can engage that as a spiritual practice, and we can appreciate that progress is something that we don't have to be afraid of. It's something that we can make, you know, we can make it more sustainable. We can continue to develop and make things better without being afraid that the inevitable accompanying problems are going to overwhelm us.
Right. So we actually have to see this as from a larger viewpoint of, well, of course there are problems. Of course it looks difficult and maybe even impossible. But that's only going to drive us deeper to come up with better solutions.
Yeah, well, I mean, within the progressive community, when you see these currents of history and you can look at things with a perspective that includes the evolution of consciousness and culture, you can see how the way forward, the way to progress, was to push off against the pathologies of the established modernist, you know, globalizing capitalist world. The antithesis, you know, to the thesis was what the next available step was. And the emergence of the kind of the progressive countercultural viewpoint has been extremely important in making progress. But the way evolution works is first there's, you know, an antithesis, first there's the transcending, then there's a synthesis, the re-including at a higher level of that which was, you know, originally transcended. And that's where we are now in the dawning of a kind of synthetic move that goes beyond merely rejecting, you know, what our ancestors and our civilization has achieved.
But that's what the postmodern time was about rejecting the modern time.
Right. In other words, in the 1960s, when the youth movement sort of burst upon the scene and the anti-establishment rejection of the American dream and the globalizing modernism, that was a very important critique. In other words, modernism had its problems had started to become larger and larger, both environmental degradation, nuclear proliferation, globalized exploitation of the vulnerable third world populations. All of these pathologies of modernism were rightly rejected by, you know, the hippies, and then later an entire major segment of the developed world. I mean, the United States, about 20% of the population is in this postmodern or progressive, countercultural, pluralistic worldview, and it's brought many important, beautiful values and indeed advanced our society, but it's because of this sort of dyed-in-the-wool anti-modernism, you know, anti-establishment, and, you know, rejectionism of everything that's good about America, of everything that's good about modernism, when taken to the extreme. Again, you know, we're talking in broad strokes here, but it's still important to see these patterns, because when you see the anti-modernism, the reflexive knee-jerk anti-modernism, you can see that that's creating its own kind of a problem. You know, an existential problem created by this postmodern counterculture is that because they're in antithesis, because they're rejecting so much of what has been accomplished, they are, in a sense, politically impotent. You know, the gravity of their values, their worldview is not attractive enough to persuade a politically significant number of modernists to join their ranks, as exemplified by the failure to effectively combat climate change, right? The biggest concern of practically every postmodernist, and they're all, you know, very activated to try to make a difference, and I am too. But why does climate change continue to score so low in political polls in terms of what Americans are most concerned about in terms of the body politic, you know, the electorate? Climate change is just not, we're not taking it seriously enough. You know, we're not recognizing the urgency of it as we should, and that's a problem. But it's a problem that the postmodernists have, and which calls for a higher level of thinking. You know, the existential problem of political impotency, the inability to persuade the rest of the society to vote and to consume and to act in ways that reflect the fragility of the environment and the warming globe. They haven't been able to get that done politically.
Well,
and
that's
the power problem, and that's where this
that's the power of modernism. Is that modernism understands how to use the media to affect propaganda to disempower climate change, or, you know, to disempower the understandings of climate change, so that so many people are influenced by misinformation that we can't get the job done.
Well, you know, that's part of it, certainly. But there's another part of it, too. And our research points to at the Institute for Cultural Evolution think tank that I'm involved with, is that part of the reason that people resist embracing a politics of sustainability is that values cohere in sets. I mean, that is, Thomas Friedman has rightly said that green should be the new red, white, and blue, right? That everyone should be concerned about the environment, regardless of their political position. And that would be great if that could happen. But he said that over 10 years ago, and green's still not the new red, white, and blue. Part of it is that because, although there's progress being made, again, everything we can talk about here we can point to exceptions. But the overall problem of combating climate change is still a political problem. And the part of the reason that the rest of the society resists embracing it is that it's a postmodern value. It's an achievement of the postmodern worldview, environmentalism, right? And because values cohere in sets, because postmodernism is inevitably responsible for and stands for environmentalism, because the rest of postmodernism is in this rejectionist position of looking with grave suspicion at everything that the establishment has achieved, the rest of the establishment, people can feel it in their gut that they're being rejected, and there's a kind of a sense in which anything that's postmodern must be resisted, even if it makes perfect sense.
But
so
it's supported.
There's a kind of a resistance to the letting the Greens win, because if people feel that the Greens win, if the environmentalists are given full political power, then that will they don't have enough care and respect for what's been achieved in terms of the modernist economy for them to not tank the economy. So now that's the fear. I'm not justifying it or saying that that's a correct perception.
No, I think the modernists are just too brazen in protecting themselves against environmentalists.
Well, there's an economic interest in there, for sure, but
yes.
You know, the economic interests point both ways. In other words, and certainly we can talk about modernism as a worldview and a kind of a demographic segment that comprises 50% of the U.S. population, but clearly these people don't vote in a bloc or think, you know, the same way. You know, their opinions are all over the map. But pulling it back to the evolution of consciousness, there's definitely dialectical tension in the system, right? There's a difference between the postmodern worldview and the modernist worldview, and that dialectical difference, which is a fact of history, which is how the step beyond got made in the first place, that is those tensions haven't been resolved, and until they are resolved through a kind of a synthetic re-inclusion, then we're going to have this political problem of resistance to the postmodern agenda.
All right, so let's come back to that, but let's go on to more of the focus of the book that has to do with our spiritual natures and how society is also dualistic, some parts trying to be non-dualistic, but that there's a dialectic, an opposition between different spiritual paths, that we want to bring them all together so that they can all embrace truth, beauty, and goodness in a powerful way.
Sure. Well, looking at this same understanding of history and culture through these through the dialectical tensions of the steps, right? In other words, evolution is not a seamless continuum. It proceeds by emergent steps. And those emergent steps are often pushing off against the problems of one level, you know, to create a new and higher and more inclusive level. So we can see there are three major stages engaged in American culture. Of course, the modernist and the postmodern, which we just spoke of, modernism being about 50%. You know, the mainstream media, academia, the education establishment, certainly the mainstream politics, are all framed by the modernist worldview, right? Then we have the counterculture, the postmodern worldview, it's about 20%. And then you still have a traditional component, pre-modern, who make meaning, you know, they frame reality according to scripture rather than science, and this is about 30%. So you have traditional worldview, the modernist worldview, and the postmodern worldview as shorthand, you know, defined terms, which we use in integral parlance.
Right.
And these stages have spiritualities, of course. So traditional spirituality has all the major world religions, you know, especially in America, the Judeo-Christian religions are well-established. About 40% of the American population goes to church on Sunday. So it's still big, although it's, you know, continuing to, it's in decline. And then you have modernism, most of which breaks out of religion, but there are still many modernists who are religious. They believe in God in one way or another. But you also have a group within modernism that are hardcore unbelievers. You know, I call this secular spirituality or a-spirituality because it's a kind of reality-framing, identity-providing, you know, loyalty-engendering worldview that competes with a religious worldview, right? The sort of a scientific materialist worldview. Then, at least since the 1970s, there has been continuing to emerge a new kind of spirituality that's not either secular or religious. It's kind of, I would label it progressive spirituality. It's certainly bigger than just what we used to call the New Age, right? That's now become a kind of a term of derision. But it includes all the progressive tropes toward rediscovering the sacred in ways that transcend traditional religion but don't fall into the kind of scientific materialist, physical frame of reality. So progressive spirituality, it's a beautiful thing that's emerged over the past decades. I've been involved with it, you know, from the time that I was able to in the early 70s, and I've defined my identity throughout my life largely by association with progressive spirituality in a variety of its forms. So I've sort of lived the history of the emergence of progressive spirituality, but I've also found myself disappointed in its potential. In other words, in the 90s, it really felt in places, you know, where the counterculture was active, where progressive spirituality was emerging. I mean, all over the country there were New Age bookstores opening, and the New Age books were, in the 90s, the biggest category of publishing in books by far. And there was a real fluorescence of progressive spirituality with, you know, celebrities like Deepak Chopra or Marianne Williamson or, you know, Oprah in her own way as a spiritual teacher. But since you know, the mid-2000s decade, progressive spirituality has kind of stalled out in its growth. You know, yoga continues to be its own vibrant, growing culture. And there are many ways in which progressive spirituality is making inroads into the establishment through things like mindfulness. But progressive spirituality is not really, it's unlikely to grow beyond the current demographic that it presently serves. And part of this is because it has its own shortcomings and limitations, and it's a kind of in keeping with the larger worldview, which is its context, right, this postmodern worldview. Progressive spirituality is coming to a kind of culmination, a maturity, which we can see in history, as I argue in the book at least, through a kind of a merger of westernized progressive Buddhism and Advaita Vedanta Hinduism, both of which are focused on a non-dual concept of ultimate reality that is based on a deep mystical experience of non-duality, and which is accessed through practices, especially meditation. So progressive spirituality continues to mature and serve humanity in many important ways, but its trajectory indicates that it's not going to sweep the nation and become a new form of loose, pluralistic spiritual consensus.
Well, it's ultimately
the reasons for that are, you know, talked about in the book. Go on.
It's ultimately very passive in that it removes the ego. It says if we're non-dual, then we don't have an ego to operate in contrariness.
Well, you know, the transcending of the moving of the seat of our spiritual identity from our ego, you know, thinking that we're our small self is who we are in totality, and coming to identify with the higher self, you know, the infinite aspect that lives within us, that's a kind of a move or admonition that almost every form of spirituality has in one form or another. But there is within the non-dual practice a very an emphasis on peaceful equanimity, about being in the now. All of which are very important elements of spirituality. You know, in Buddhism, there's the doctrine of wise non-attachment. And the wise non-attachment is, of course, a spiritual goal, a value-creating stance by itself, but it evokes a kind of a polarity, an opposite side, which is both positive. It's not positive-negative. It's that the polarity is positive-positive. You know, Houston Smith, the religious scholar, is famous for saying that the opposite of a small truth is a falsehood, but the opposite of a great truth is an equal and opposite great truth. And that's this idea of these spiritual truths occupying a structure which is known as an interdependent polarity. So the interdependent polarity of non-duality, wise non-attachment, is in contrast to another pole of loving engagement, of selfless service, of a kind of a striving to develop and grow spiritually. And of course, the spirituality, especially within progressive spirituality, is pretty well blended. So a lot of the distinctive features of the non-dual and what's known as the theistic or God-centered form of spirituality become kind of, you know, blended and fuzzed up in a way that it's all good and they're all paths to the same mountains. And that's an understandable strength of progressive spirituality, that the letting a thousand flowers bloom, the welcoming of all spiritual paths, a kind of pluralistic inclusivism. These are extreme, these are ways that progressive spirituality has transcended religious exclusivism and the shortcomings of religious, traditional spirituality. But that same kind of eclectic pluralism has its own problems. It has a sort of a problem with relativism, whereby we, in this fuzzed-up realm of everything is spiritual, it's hard to see these higher truths of spiritual paths pointing to peaceful equanimity and spiritual paths pointing to loving engagement. You can see this in the concept of ultimate reality itself. There's the concept of ultimate reality, which is non-dual. That is, it's all one thing, and there's no separation, and we're all part of the same thing, and that makes us interdependent, binds us as a family, you know, all the values of connectedness come from the concept of that we're all one, and that's certainly true. But we're also individuals. We're real beings in our own right who can love and be loved as individuals. And this love element is very important conceptually to understand because love is irreducibly relational. You know, in other words, if there's no separation in the universe, the idea of love has a hard time finding its ground because if there's no separation, then there's really no relationships. The relationships themselves are an illusion, right, which makes it a problem to locate something as relational as love within an ontology, you know, within a reality frame.
It's too easy.
There's no separation.
It's too easy to say that love is oneness and therefore
it
has nowhere to go.
By reclaiming the theistic side of things.
So what we're looking for here is the drive towards evolution, which, as you say, is like gravity of the drive to evolve more truth, beauty, and goodness. So we want to see how to maximize that in each of these various progressive ways.
Sure. That's another element of the book, and indeed a central feature of evolutionary spirituality, is the recognition of the evolutionary impulse, right, which we share with all life. All life has the impulse to survive and reproduce, the will to live, right? And it goes all the way down to, you know, cells that have the will to live, in a sense, you know, at least amoebas. You can see them swimming up the gradient toward the sugar and away from the toxins. You can see them reproducing. And this same impulse to survive and reproduce itself evolves as the tree of life becomes more complex, you know, as animal consciousness evolves, animal needs grow beyond just surviving and reproducing. They start to have social needs and caring for their offspring in ways that are a beautiful evolution of this impulse to survive and to reproduce and to live a good life for at whatever level your life is. But the same impulse that we feel biologically in our own bodies in humans evolves to a kind of a sense of longing for beyond values that go beyond surviving and reproducing, values that include the beautiful, the true, and the good, and that the eros or the attraction that we feel for these values is a kind of, can be recognized as a kind of gravity, a value gravity, that the more that our consciousness evolves, the more of this gravity gains traction on us, the more it excites and attracts our evolutionary impulses toward self-actualization, toward the appreciation of beauty, you know, the learning of truth, and you know, the recognition of goodness. But it goes beyond that. The practice that goes with this understanding of the evolutionary impulse and the gravity of values is the practice of creating these values ourselves in our work. In other words, we are agents of evolution, you know, co-creators of the universe who've been, you know, given the power through our free will to recognize what's beautiful, true, and good at higher and higher levels, right? That is, each one of these worldviews we've been talking about is like an octave of beauty, truth, and goodness. And these values themselves are how we make the universe more perfect. I spoke earlier of this practice of perfecting the universe. We perfect the universe by making it more beautiful, by discovering more truth, you know, by teaching the truth, and by doing service, by making things better, by helping people and serving people and being kind and devoting our lives to making the world a better place.
And it seems to me that this needs to be the focus of finding synthesis so that everybody can make the most of their evolution differently, yet for this greater purpose of truth, beauty, and goodness.
Yeah, in other words, the postmodern worldview that we've been talking about, the progressive, countercultural, sensitive worldview, has really made some important strides. And you think, well, how can we go beyond that? How can we be more loving and caring and sensitive and environmentally friendly? Well, the answer is we can better include the values of the previous stages. We can better include the values of modernism and the values of traditionalism and even the values of the pre-traditional stages. Each stage, each octave of beauty, truth, and goodness has important values that we need to carry forward, even as we prune away the pathologies of each level. So being able to include more, being able to increase the scope of what we're able to value is a direction of evolution itself, and that's what's offered by this evolutionary perspective.
Right, and understanding that we should do our best not to be an antithesis, rather to become a synthesis.
Well, we can see that the antithesis is a necessary step. In other words, if we're going to transcend modernism and we're going to make it, we're going to create a world that works for everyone, that's more environmentally friendly and more compassionate, and there's greater social justice,
right,
the first step is to push off against modernism and say, you know, this can't be all there is. You know, the world, you know, globalizing materialistic consumer culture is not the future we want to embrace. But so the antithesis is necessary. We can't just diss the antithesis and say that that's something we don't want, because without the antithesis, without the accomplishments of the pushing away, then this next opportunity to try to re-include at a higher level wouldn't be there.
Right. So
again,
we have
to recognize each step in this cultural ecosystem that we find ourselves in. Each step is creating value in an ongoing way. You know, this antithesis of postmodernism is a permanent part of the structure. Now, it can mature, it can become less anti-modern, it can as a stage, point to and help become a kind of an upward escalator to a more synthetic evolutionary position, but we can't just sort of say we want to reject it or get rid of it in the same way that stage can't get rid of modernism, because it's a necessary step or a brick in the wall. You know, it's part of the architecture of civilization, and our job is to improve it without eliminating it.
Right, so it's not complete rejection. It's just finding the best parts of it and including them in the progress moving forward.
Right. And so that helps lessen the anti-modernism that rejects, you know, much of our civilization and what's good about America. And it allows us to reclaim those goods even while we are still wary of the crimes and we're still wary of the pathologies it's not relativism. The difference is that there's a vertical dimension of value development, right? We're able to say with confidence which way is up, and we want to argue for that direction of progress, those directions of evolution. We want to try to persuade people to agree with us. That's how all moral progress is made, is you try to widen the scope of those worthy of moral consideration. And so part of the project of giving birth to this evolutionary perspective is being able to tease apart the dignities from the disasters. Being able to see that when you look at a previous stage like modernism or traditionalism, it's not all pathology. There's really important values there, and how to carry those values forward and identify with those values and make them our own and treasure them.
We're going to have to end the show because we've reached the point of no return.
Okay.
So it's great having you as a guest on Energy Stew, and hopefully I can have you a guest again in some time in the future. Your book, The Presence of the Infinite, and your name is Steve McIntosh, McIntosh. And what's a website for you?
SteveMcIntosh.com is the headquarters for my work, and people can also see the think tank website at culturalevolution.org. So SteveMcIntosh.com or culturalevolution.org.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure speaking with you.
Yeah, same here. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.FM. I can be reached at peter@heartriver, heartriver.org, or 212-222-7748. I'd love to hear from you, and thank you so much for listening.